Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Mike Pfeiffer, and you're listening to the Cloud Skills FM podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Cloud Skills FM. Really appreciate you being here. And in this episode, I'm talking to Chris Short. He is on the Ansible team at Red Hat. He's also a CNCF ambassador. And we're going to have a great episode because we have a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, you bet. You know, I know you've been in the game for a long time, since the late 90s, like a lot of us, like me especially. And I know that you're working on some cool stuff these days with Ansible at Red Hat. But would love to hear your background and then maybe take us up to what you're working on today at Red Hat.
Sure. So yeah, my background, as you mentioned, started in the late 80s. I was an MIS technician for all the really old people out there at 15 years old working for a textile company. Worked my way kind of through a bunch of different jobs, you know, IT jobs in high school. And then my senior year of high school was actually a webmaster at a dial-up ISP in Hickory, North Carolina. And then the dot-com bubble happened and there were not many jobs. And I ended up joining the Air Force. Did a lot of very cool things for the Air Force and, you know, kind of went through the 9-11, post-9-11, OEF, OIF. Ended up getting hurt after getting back from OIF during a hurricane exercise in South Florida. So, yeah, that was fun. Got out in 2010, have been in the web ops and DevOps space up until last year. I traded in the pager. I was a DevOps consultant working with John Willis and his group. And then hung up my pager, joined Red Hat on the Ansible team, where I've kind of been bridging the gaps between, you know, two really, really awesome projects. The number one project, Kubernetes, which I've been working in that community for about 2 years now. And then the number seven project on GitHub, which is Ansible, and kind of like pulling the two together from like the Ansible side, you know, kind of bringing the Kubernetes into the Ansible organization and saying, hey, like, let's get in here. There's stuff we can do. We can make this easier for people.
Yeah.
Let's go. And that's kind of what I've been working on lately. So that's the elevator pitch, I guess, for me.
Yeah, I had flashbacks of the beginnings of my career when you were talking about working for dial-up ISPs and stuff like that. It's fun times. It's amazing how things have changed.
Oh, but it's had changed, but stays the same, right? Like, like, you know, it's the internet. You know what's going to happen if you do this, and you still do it. Yes, good job. All right.
Yeah. It was the what we call back in the old days, the information superhighway, and now it's just the internet.
Oh, my God. Now it's just everywhere, right? The web. Like, and then people correct you. There's more to it than just the web.
Yeah, there's so the dark web, right?
You got to watch out. Yeah. The dark web. So scared.
So, anyways, I'm really interested to hear about your work with Ansible, obviously your work with Kubernetes, because everyone's talking about it like crazy. But I think that there's a lot of people that hear about Ansible, maybe they're not super familiar with that. So I'd love to have you kind of fill us in on what that is, why it's useful, how people are using it, and then we can get into how you're integrating it with your work in Kubernetes.
Sure. So like, I don't want to make it like a product pitch, but so I'll just tell you like my Ansible story. I think that's as compelling as, you know, like our product marketing story. So in, you know, 2014, 2015, I forget, you know, the exact year, but mid 2010s, I was working for a large, you know, essentially data center company, Hosted Solutions, which has been acquired and traded off multiple times, I'm sure by now. But the data centers were across the country and mainly VMware based data centers. And there was a portal that was deployed for customers to manage all their resources within their, you know, the managed data center tooling. So that portal was written in Java and kind of like completely wholly managed by the development team. And it was very, very flaky and unstable and needed like some operations love. So I was brought on board to help stabilize that deployment process. And it was kind of like the position was created for someone to come in and fix this thing that was, you know, being broken a lot. And come to find out, there was no kind of standard deployment process. There was no like documentation. It was always the developers diving in and just debugging on the fly. And then, okay, let's flip the load balancer over and see what happens. And off they went with live traffic. So yeah, there was a lot of, I mean, they had, you know, test, dev, and, you know, staging environment and then production. Sure, they did all those, you know, checks, but they still needed a standard deployment process for all of that. And, you know, we started evaluating tools, and Puppet was the popular one at the time. Had the majority of the market share, I think, you know, as far as like enterprise adoption goes. You know, went to, you know, I had used Puppet at my previous position, but wasn't like super hands-on and actually standing up the entire environment. So went to some Puppet training, spent a week in class. And I was like, all right, well, okay, cool. Let me check out Ansible real quick. I'll give it a weekend. If, you know, if I see after this training more value in Puppet, great. So I sit down on a Friday night. This was back when, you know, my daughter was away at school and I didn't have young Max running around. I sat down on a Friday night in my office, spent 4 hours with Ansible, and I was productive within 4 hours, actually deploying a website, actually had moved the deployment of my website over to Ansible by the next day. So, you know, what did Ansible do for me? It automated everything from standing up a cloud environment to managing databases to actually deploying Ghost was the, you know, web engine that I was using for my blog at the time. And doing all those pieces and intricately backing everything up, pulling it down, saving a copy locally just in case, putting a copy in S3, you know, just an extra case, and like actually, you know, restoring everything once you've upgraded the front end. And doing all that magically with Ansible in one, you know, basically one night, one long day of work, essentially 12 hours of work, was magical. So like off we went with Ansible and we started deploying that portal with Ansible as soon as we could and immediately started finding the real problems. And it wasn't the fact that, you know, that people could, you know, deploy code to production. It was the fact that people could deploy code to production. There was no checks or balances. There was no kind of deviation changes. So those lessons learned, like those change settings and config files, were going to get overwritten now. So now we could actually like automate and then detect changes and then, you know, figure out, hey, why was this change made? Oh, cool. Let's build it into the config file. Let's actually automate, you know, the reasons behind this change. So we're actually now building lessons learned into the automation platform. And this was all up and running, you know, within months, you know, developers on board and everything. So it's a really easy sell for all kinds of automation tasks when I can tell somebody, hey, I knew nothing about it. And within 4 hours, I was productive with it. And I can find tweets today of people saying that.
Right.
It's pretty remarkable after all these years. So that's kind of where I came in with Ansible, you know, mid-2010s.
Yeah, I mean, 2010 sometimes to me, it doesn't seem like that long ago. And then I look at the calendar, I'm like, yeah, that was almost 10 years ago. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, like... So like Ansible was born in 2012. I think I picked it up in 2014 and was like actually working with it in 2015, like on a day-to-day basis. So that's just to give you an idea of how quick it was up and how quick it was to become a professional with it, if that makes sense. Because it became like a simpler way to do all the things because it standardized the language in which you did all the things.
Right.
And off you went. So when you have a standard language, it makes everything a lot easier.
I had a similar impression with it, you know, working with that compared to things like Chef and Puppet, especially 5 years ago when that's all everybody was talking about was configuration management tools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, Ansible is very easy to get up and started with. And I think it speaks volumes that you sat through 5 days of, or whatever it was, 4 or 5 days of training, still wondering, like, is this Puppet thing going to work? And then overnight, you just dug into Ansible and made it go. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a better story than that, right? Like hands-on actual experience, right? Like now we're deploying a portal for a platform that, you know, a multi-million-dollar business is doing with Ansible in a matter of months to include like these people didn't want to automate this and now they're automating things and using Ansible with it in months is amazing to me.
Right. Yeah. And it's one of the things I was talking about this with somebody the other day. They were asking about Chef and Puppet. And obviously, those are great tools.
Oh, they're marvelous tools.
Awesome services. But I haven't heard a lot about them over the last couple of years. And it seems like I hear a lot more about Ansible lately, which is interesting. But kind of switching gears from there, you know, what is it that you're doing with Ansible now in Kubernetes? I know you've been working on some interesting stuff. And I think that everybody listening would be interested.
Yeah. So, Kubernetes, right? Like I started, you know, I became familiar with Kubernetes a couple of years ago, literally 2 years ago. Well, maybe three now. And I, you know, I got involved with Kubernetes because I needed a job. I ended up at KubeCon, meeting some people, talking to some people, ended up becoming a CNCF ambassador. And then, you know, I was working with Kubernetes more and more on a day-to-day basis. Then coming over to the Ansible side, working in Red Hat, they're like, oh, you have experience with Kubernetes. Oh, well, engineering, you know, one of our engineers and some of the OpenShift engineers are now working on this thing called an operator. And I'm like, well, I know kind of what an operator is, but what do you mean? And they're like, oh, using Ansible as an operator in Kubernetes. And I'm like, interesting. Tell me more. So months of work go into it. And out comes, you know, Ansible within the operator SDK. If you're not familiar with, you know, Kubernetes, answers the question of what do I do with all these containers, right? Like developers can spin up whole environments and containers and hand them off to operations and be like, okay, run them. But how do you run that at scale? Kubernetes kind of answers that question and a lot of other ones along the way. You know, how do you monitor that? How do you scale horizontally with that? Kubernetes has solutions and use cases for all those problems. When you throw in things like, hey, now I've got this huge, you know, Kubernetes environment, I really don't want to spend a ton of money on databases anymore, right? Like, I want to shove those into containers and, you know, manage databases. Well, now you're talking like at a lot of operational work going into a Kubernetes environment. So that's where operators come in. Operators can manage like day two operations is basically what I'm calling it inside of a Kubernetes cluster. So for example, you have an HA pair database, you know, master, secondary, and one goes down. The secondary goes offline. You want to make sure a new one comes online and has a, you know, new copy of everything from the master or a backup, you know, that was recently taken, and then, you know, bring over what is left over from the backup and live production data after the backup is restored. You can do all that automatically with an operator. That's a lot of things that I just said in one tiny ball of code. Well, originally you could only write, well, you could write operators and a lot of things, but it was originally only written in Go. Traditionally still is written in Go. And, you know, Go is a great language. I can't write as much Go as I can Ansible. And there's a lot more people that know Ansible than Go. And that's where the two kind of came together and said, hey, Ansible has a Kubernetes module. If we can make some changes to that, we can actually use the Cates module from Ansible and the operator SDK together to basically take the entire Ansible toolkit and port it into now something that you can use for day two operations within Kubernetes clusters. And that is kind of magical to me, because what that does is that lowers the barrier to entry to Kubernetes, which I thought Ansible lowered the barrier to entry for like system administration and DevOps. It's going to do the same thing for Kubernetes now. And that's just so magical to me. And I'm happy to be a part of that process.
Yeah, that's really interesting stuff. I've heard a lot of people too talking about Go, a lot of people trying to ramp up on Go. And it's a good point that you made that you can just, a lot of people are going to be able to leverage those existing Ansible skills to do some of that work. What's a good way for somebody to maybe get started with this if they're brand new to that? Maybe they've been messing around with Kubernetes and maybe they have some Ansible experience and didn't realize they could leverage that. What's a good way to maybe get a hello world exercise going, or what's a good place for them to start?
Yeah. So like, I think the biggest thing is like, you're not going to get a hello world. You're going to get a hello, a bunch of stuff was just dumb, right? Like that's, I think, step one. Sure, you could, you know, output to a log file or, hey, look at an event and watch it happen, you know, live in your cluster kind of thing. But definitely, you know, if you want to learn more, ansible.com/operators is the probably best place, I think, to kind of choose and pick what you need to, you know, get running. There's even kind of courses that are linked from there. Another podcast like this one from two of the developers from the OpenShift side talking about operators and, you know, how Ansible is, you know, getting incorporated there. But I think the biggest thing to remember is that, like, if you know Ansible and you kind of understand the premises of Kubernetes, you can now merge the two skills together with just a little bit of effort.
Nice.
So that's a very nice dovetail for me as far as, like, you know, career wise.
Yeah, no doubt. Because now you can start getting in kind of the game of overriding and customizing and almost becoming a developer in the Kubernetes world by just leveraging Ansible stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny how history repeats itself, right? Like, we had, you know, mainframe operators, you know, back in the day. Now we have Kubernetes operators, but hey, now we're using like languages to manage operations automatically. So now we got to have people that manage the automation, and that is all inside Kubernetes. And now those people are going to be called like Kubernetes engineers or cloud native operators or whatever you want to call them. It's interesting how just history is just repeating itself, but now we're maybe throwing in a little automation along the way.
Right. It's funny. I was having that same conversation with some folks last week. It's just like, if you've been in this field for a couple of decades, like we have, you do start to see the same patterns repeated over and over. Different names are on things and high level concepts are the same, basically.
Yeah. But I mean, there's still a ton of COBOL out there, right? Like, I live outside of Detroit. I can show you tall skyscrapers running on COBOL right now. Right. Like, it's still there. It's not going to go away anytime soon. So it'll be interesting to see, like, Kubernetes is going to bring in like container orchestration and, you know, hopefully kind of level the playing field knowledge wise, as far as what you need to be kind of this cloud engineer or this cloud developer, as far as infrastructure goes. So now it'll be interesting to see, like, what gets built on top of Kubernetes in the future. And some people are saying it's serverless, some people are saying it's this, it's that. I'm thinking, right, like, you know, mainframes, that was a long time ago. Look at what we've done since then. You know, look at what we're going to do from Kubernetes. It's kind of going to be interesting to see.
Yeah. And since you've been involved with it so long, that's a question I'd love to ask you is, do you feel like, you know, with all the hype, right, there's tons of stuff online and, you know, you look at social every day on the news for tech, it's just all Kubernetes, it seems like. So somebody like yourself that's been in it so long, does that really feel to you that like that's where everything is going?
Yeah, no, maybe. I am not, you know, yes, I have a title of CNCF ambassador, but I am not one to just shill for something, right? Like, I freely admit that I use, you know, Google has the ability to just run like one EC2 instance with one container on it. Yeah, I use that for quite a few things because sometimes I only need one container to do something for me every once in a while. Kubernetes is not the right solution for everybody, right? Like, so don't just run Kubernetes because you need to run containers, right? Like, there's ways to run containers other than Kubernetes. There are ways to run Kubernetes that might make more sense than, you know, something like OpenShift. You might want something more lightweight or something, you know, you might, like a lot of people do, just run vanilla Kubernetes and see how that goes for you and then end up realizing that you need a little help along the way. So sky's kind of the limit as far as where I think it could go. What I kind of want to see happen, I think, is, you know, as Kubernetes grows, we realize that Kubernetes kind of just runs just fine on bare metal. And when you have a bare metal data center full of Kubernetes, you know, nodes, it's actually just fine. So we're going to start seeing these really, really, really complex VMs that, you know, were, you know, .NET code and haven't been touched in years, kind of just need to be pushed into a Kubernetes cluster. I want to see that kind of problem get solved somehow in a cloud native Kubernetes way. And there's some projects out there, Kata Containers, Kubevert, a few others that are kind of working in that direction. And then I also want to see more line of business kind of operations getting containerized, right? Like, there's tons of like chatbots running across the web right now, right? Like, I'm running a Telegram bot right now that's running on a Kubernetes cluster, right? Like, it's doing things for me to like keep spammers out of my community, right? Like, I want more things like that automated and put into a Kubernetes cluster in the future. So that means I want finance, HR, those people, I want them involved in figuring out what we can do to make their lives easier.
It's kind of interesting when something takes off like this and then, you know, the whole ecosystem kind of evolves or matures around it. And then, you know, if you didn't get in the game, then you're left kind of like with what's there for you. And so that's kind of what I'm wondering is going to happen is, you know, are a lot of companies going to kind of, well, not a lot, but are some going to avoid this and then have to do it the hard way later on down the road? Which kind of leads me to my next question, which is really more basic, actually. Being someone that's so deep into Linux, you know, we've got a lot of people listening that are in the Azure space that are Windows server focused now kind of transitioning into cloud and realizing, wow, Microsoft's really changing their focus. They're doing a lot of open source work. It really seems like they're hot on Linux.
Yeah.
Are you getting that impression? And how important do you think it is for folks without Linux skills to start building those skills?
So it's funny. I think if you've gone all this time without Linux skills, and when I say all this time, I mean, like, if you've gone 2 or 3 years in IT and you haven't been exposed to some smidgen of Linux somewhere, right? Like, I feel like you need to start diving in now. But the biggest thing is, like, you need to be comfortable with what you're currently doing before you expand outwards. Once you're comfortable with that, or once you're comfortable with the idea of, I know I need to learn more, getting started with Linux is not as hard as it used to be. Let me tell you, the good old days, it was not fun to try and just compile your own kernel. Now it's like, there's thousands of them ready to go for you. Pick one, add a module at your leisure. It's super, super fun and easy to learn now. And there's lots and lots of platforms to learn it on. If you're trying to get started, ask for help. There's lots of Linux user groups out there. There's lots of, you know, Red Hat user groups. There's lots of other, you know, Linux type communities and meetups that would be happy to help you learn Linux and, you know, just kind of where it came from, why it exists, and why it's gotten so popular.
Yeah, that's good advice, especially like the part where you said, you know, make sure you're comfortable with what you're working on now before you expand out. And that's important. Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree more there. The other thing that you mentioned as well is, well, I guess there was a couple things there that were really interesting, but I just thought of something I was going to ask you earlier, and then I kind of forgot, and then circle back to that. When it comes to working with, you know, getting started with Ansible, like just from the basics. I know a lot of people on the call or on the listen to the podcast, I should say, you know, they've done a lot of stuff with, we got a lot of folks that are into PowerShell, into Bash and doing some basic automation, maybe some infrastructure as code. But what's a good way to get started with Ansible? What's a good maybe set of resources available from Red Hat that folks could use to get started?
So the Ansible website, ansible.com, is like the best place to just get started. There's tons of getting started content, you know, packaged in multiple different formats, right? It's like if you read ebooks, we got an ebook for you. If you like videos, we got videos. If you like webinars, we got webinars. So there's enough getting started content out there, especially from the community too, right? Like starting at ansible.com is just the beginning, right? Like the Ansible community is massive. Going and getting from Jeff Geerling, he has a great book, Ansible for DevOps. I highly recommend that. There's, you know, tons of like up and running with Ansible kinds of books. I think O'Reilly has one that's very good. You know, there's a wide variety of content, but I think the biggest thing is like learning Ansible is great, but what problem are you trying to solve with Ansible? And then figuring that out from there might be the best thing. If you're, you know, if you have a problem setting up new users for whatever reason, go figure out how Ansible can solve that for you first and then go from there. I think that's the best way to learn and get started, in my opinion.
It's a great point. I was just talking to a customer last week, in fact, when it was just a two-day kind of discovery, look at how they got things set up and make some basic recommendations, and got about halfway through the second day and realized that they didn't really have a plan, and they were just, they felt obligated to get into this technology, and they didn't have any true reason. And I had that same exact conversation with them. It's like, what are you guys trying to solve here? Because the shotgun approach, right, is just kind of like too much information. You got to hone in on what it is you're trying to solve.
Well, I think a lot of people are afraid they don't want to miss on the next technological innovation that'll give them the next tiny little advantage against their competitors, right? Like,
right.
There's so much buzz around Kubernetes, and, you know, a lot of it is buzz. I'll freely admit that. But, you know, like, for example, when I see Business Insider commenting on like the fifth anniversary of Kubernetes, I'm like, well, that's buzz. When I see people that are actually solving real problems and saying, yes, we built our entire platform on Kubernetes because it just made life easier for everybody to begin with once we figured out how to use it, I think that is more telling than anything. The most telling things, I think, is like this industry-wide shift that kind of happened the past 2 or 3 years towards Kubernetes, right? Like you had people that were not touching Kubernetes but still doing container orchestration. Now they have a Kubernetes product or a project they're working on. And I think that kind of, to me, I started seeing that trend a couple of years ago, well, 2, 3, 4 years ago now, and getting ahead of that, I think, is important. But more important is, you know, understanding why you need to get ahead of it. And that's because now I have all these containers and I do have a problem managing them all, and I'm going to need something to manage all this for me at some point.
Right. How important do you think, or how useful, like, do you think for folks that really are, you know, going down the road of Kubernetes, or they want to be working somewhere where that's used because they see, you know, they're interested in the technology, they see the opportunity. Do you feel like the certifications and the CNCF certifications are a pretty good way to go for somebody? Is there any, understand that they require a lot of hands-on, it's all performance-based. Any insights into that?
So yeah, the CNCF certifications for Kubernetes are quality, right? But keep in mind, Kubernetes is young. Certification processes, you know, evolve over time. So right now it is very much hands-on. Like you need to know your stuff, right? Like you need to know kubectl, Git, pods, blah, blah, blah. Like, and that's it, right? Like there's no Google for you. So there's going to be very hands-on. It's going to be very, 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 very technical. So probably not the best place to get started, but definitely like a best place to get a checkpoint, right? Like if you've been using and working and, you know, teaching yourself Kubernetes for 6 months to a year, go dive into one of those certs to kind of get an idea of where you stand. I think that's, you know, totally cool.
I was just wondering kind of, you know, how tough it would actually be for somebody to actually dive into that. Is it going to be worth it for them?
I would not recommend to anybody like to dive in to the certification as like getting started with Kubernetes. That's no, I would steer you away from that. I would say, please figure out what you want to do with Kubernetes before you go ahead and learn it. Right. Like,
right.
Simply learning a technology doesn't mean you need to necessarily use it, right? Like you need to know why you're learning this technology. So yeah, like the certs are great. I think it's important to have them if you're working on it day to day. I think it's important to have for your organization to kind of prove, you know, organizational knowledge, but not a great getting started point right now. That's not to say that in the future, the CNCF isn't looking at that.
Yeah, so kind of what I was going to ask you was a follow-up, or, you know, if they're going to have any entry-level stuff. So like you said, it's still super early.
Yeah, and we're starting to see like this breakout starting to happen, right? And I think it's already happened to an extent, but, you know, in a few years ago, it was Kelsey Towers, Kubernetes the Hard Way, which is this huge GitHub project that Kelsey Hightower, who's, you know, this awesome, awesome, awesome engineer and evangelist at Google, he put together like actually how to build all the parts and pieces of a good Kubernetes cluster by hand, you know, so that you could figure out all the innards of, you know, all the different processes and tools that make a full-blown Kubernetes cluster. You know, back 3 years ago, like that was the starting point for Kubernetes knowledge. And that was just way too deep. I think there has been this split with as far as like Kubernetes knowledge goes, right? Like how to operate a healthy cluster, how to maintain apps within that cluster, how to, you know, leverage the Kubernetes primitives as a operations or developer type person, I think is one direction, right? So think of it as like a Kubernetes operator as a human being, and then think of it as like that Kubernetes maintainer, right? So back in my Air Force days, I sat in between two groups of people as far as like in the technology handoff of humanity that was, you know, Air Force communications. I sat in between satellite operators and system operators, right? So I was the network glue in the middle that tied everything together. Those are going to be your Kubernetes maintainers, right? Like they're going to figure out how to get these disparate workloads that have these different requirements and these different, you know, needs that, you know, make the difference between, hey, on this cluster, we need to use Calico, and on this cluster, we need to use another CNI, right? Like there's reasons for making all these decisions, and those maintainers are going to have that level of knowledge. But then the operator is going to be those ones that are like, hey, I've got this huge cluster. I know how to like make full use of it. I know how to help apps get on board here. Let's push in that direction.
Right. It's good stuff. I was just actually taking a look at, looks like on Katacoda, there is a lesson for making an operator with Ansible that they walk you through.
Yes. So there's actually quite a bit of like, learn how to use an Ansible operator, and it's all hands on, right? Like you get access to commands and you do things on a real, figuratively real environment. So yeah, if you mess up, it gives you the errors. If you type in the right thing, it does real things. Yeah, it's Katacoda all the way, and it's fully built. The OpenShift team has been working very hard on making sure that there's plenty of getting started content out there, because we do realize that if you are just getting started in IT and you jump into Kubernetes, right, like that is a very deep pool.
All right.
So let's make this a little bit easier for everyone.
Have you found that people, especially that are new, have a problem with all the YAML that's involved? Or, you know, because I hear a lot of people complaining about JSON, and I get it because it's expressive and it's so much more bloated.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a lot of people that are new stumble with YAML? Because, you know, there's probably people listening that haven't even got started with it.
So I think YAML's become so ubiquitous now that people are just kind of used to it, if that makes sense, right? Like, I remember when someone told me, hey, you got to go learn YAML, you got the weekend to learn it. And I looked at the spec and I was like, it's a lot of white space. Right. Humans aren't good at seeing negative space. This is going to be fun.
Right.
And now, like, the whole industry has adopted it, right? Like I said, Ansible uses it, Kubernetes uses it. It's used in a lot of other places. You know, it's a markup language, right? Like HTML is everywhere. It wasn't the only markup language at the time, but it's everywhere now. YAML is everywhere now. There'll be other ones later. As far as like learning curve, yeah, it's difficult. But the first thing I tell people is like linters are a thing. Use them like all the time, right? Like
right.
Auto formatting tools and IDEs exist, right? Like this isn't, you know, old school artisanally crafted automation. This is like Ansible code. Let's get it done, right? Like let's make Ansible automation happen. Let's not spend a whole lot of time figuring out, hey, is it two spaces for a tab or four, right? Like, it's, I don't want to call it necessarily evil, because it's way better than some other things, right? As far as YAML goes, or, you know, other things, XML, not dumping on XML, but XML, when I first started it, you know, it was just like, whoa, there's just way more like syntax than actual information in this thing. How do I navigate it? It just wasn't like a natural fit for me. So I think YAML is closer than JSON was, than XML was, right? Like, so we're getting there, I think, right? It's slowly but surely.
Right. Yeah, I think it all boils down to giving you the ability to move fast. The speed at which you can do things is why these things get adopted, usually. Makes it flexible, makes it more simple. And I think that whether it's JSON or YAML, like you can pick that stuff up pretty quick. I've had people ask me, like, what training class should I get to? And it's like, you could probably pick it up in an hour or two if you just mess around with it. And
yeah, I think the biggest thing is just like using it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how I learned how to that's how I kind of got into web stuff, was just learning how to write a web page back in the mid 90s or late 90s, right? Like I copied other HTML and then, hey, it doesn't work. Keep tinkering with it till it does. Thankfully, there's more documentation now, so you don't have to tinker as much.
Yeah, you got YouTube now, so you could literally...
I know, there's so many different ways to learn YAML now. Like, I mean, I think about it when I was learning YAML in 2011, it was like, where was all this then? It's like, wow. Right.
I think about that too, because I was doing web development in the late 90s as well, just kicking the tires, trying to figure it out, and looking back...
That's when CSS was easy.
Yeah. Now, like... Man, if I would have had YouTube at that in that day and age, I would have been such a great web developer. But
wow. Yeah, like I remember downloading an MP3 for the first time and like showing people that like, yeah, you could totally get music off the internet. They were just mind blown.
Yeah, and Napster and Kazaa and all that stuff.
All that stuff took off like immediately after I was doing those demos. It's like, check this out. Yeah. Like, here you go. I remember visiting a buddy at a college campus, and college campuses back then, there was just like a big flat network or big whole network segments were just flat. So if you had like a window share or some kind of file share, all your stuff was out there and everybody could see it and copy it. Just, here you go.
Yep. That's so funny that you said that, because I used to know of a computer lab on a college campus where every machine literally had a public IP address like on the network interface.
Wow.
You could go back to your dorm room and literally like, you know... Mm-hmm. Hit the UNC path to the C drive share on the computer that you were
nice.
On.
Wow. Yeah.
Things have changed a little bit since then, I guess.
Yeah. But like I said, you know, things kind of still stay the same, right? Like I remember I worked at a job that was, you know, had HIPAA compliance as, you know, a necessity, and they had a iOS app, super cool iOS app. They were downloading, you know, using it to, you know, using the front facing camera to do some analysis and, you know, help parents make a diagnosis one way or another if their child had autism. You know, kind of, you know, should I seek help or not kind of scenario. And they were downloading the videos. It was awesome doing all this analysis, giving parents information back, like real time on the device, but they needed sample data. So they were storing the sample data, you know, from all these different videos and captures and everything else. And that, you know, analytical data was all stored, you know, inside the, you know, the systems network on a highly secured wide open NFS server, right? It's like, yeah, it's inside the firewall, but
it's always room for improvement and everything that we do.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like this is, yes. Can we maybe put these someplace else? Right. Like in an actual like protected area, encrypted somewhere.
Yep. Well, Chris, I've really enjoyed this episode, man. I'm glad you came on and shared your insight, because I believe that it's going to help a lot of people just hearing from you and what you're working on. I want to get people kind of pointed to your stuff as we wrap up this episode. Where can people find you online and see what you're working on?
So I actually have like 3 points of presence online. I've been around that long. So I have my like blog/website, chrisshort.net. I've had that since like 2003. I run a newsletter called DevOps-ish. So DevOps with ish on the end, because there's a lot more to it than just DevOps, I think. That's devopsish.com. You'll find links from chrisshort.net to there. And then obviously work stuff is ansible.com. You can find me on the blog, the Ansible Twitter account, everything. I'm around.
Awesome. Yeah. The ansible.com, actually there's so much resources that I was just going to while you were talking. That's a great place to go, including like all the other stuff you're doing. But I really appreciate it, Chris.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for having me on.
Want to keep up with what's going on in cloud computing? If so, subscribe to my weekly newsletter and get my top 5 tips every week for staying on top of Azure, AWS, and Google Cloud. Just go to askmike.io/subscribe to join today. Every week, I'll send out information about cloud architecture and development, containerized applications with Docker and Kubernetes, DevOps and automation, and strategies for getting the latest cloud computing certifications. So if that sounds awesome to you, go to askmike.io/subscribe to join the list today.